Rolling.
This is the Fed Sock Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The Fed Sock Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Okay, so here's the deal. Your persons, houses, papers, and effects are protected under the Fourth Amendment. Full stop. But what about digital information? Well, the data on electronic devices isn't private. It's shared with hundreds or even thousands of third parties. And what those third parties do with your data, especially when the government wants to see it? Well, that's complicated. Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your warranted host. We made a film called Cats on the Internet about privacy in the digital age. I have here with me Professor Jeffrey Bellin, a professor at William & Mary Law School and an expert on criminal law and procedure, to discuss the meaning of a key term in the Fourth Amendment and how the interpretation of that term affects privacy in the United States. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me on.
We're sure glad to have you. So what got you interested in the Fourth Amendment?
Well, it's just interesting, right? Who's not interested in the Fourth Amendment? I don't even know if I can think of exactly why, but I was a criminal litigator at some point, and then, but I think even before that, even in law school, I was interested in the Fourth Amendment because it's so important and affects everything.
No question about it. Do you think your experience as a prosecutor informs your scholarship at all?
Yeah, I think so. I think it helps me to understand what are the issues that people are actually fighting about out there, and also the importance of having clear rules to guide people who are working with this language that don't have the time and expertise of, say, the Supreme Court.
Gotcha. So as an expert in this area, what would you say are some of the biggest issues today?
Well, I think you hit on it in your introduction. One of the places that there's a strong need for clarification has to do with the application of Fourth Amendment doctrine to modern technologies and data, and how that data. So basically what's happened is that we've changed how we communicate with each other and how we store private information. And it's been a challenge for the courts to adapt the law, and particularly the Fourth Amendment, to apply to these new spaces and new technologies.
Gotcha. So a lot has changed since the, let's say, early 2000s, right?
It's too big a question. I know you're pausing for me to say more, but there's too much to say. So I have to wait for another question before I say anything else.
No, I absolutely got you there. There's a lot tangled in here. Now, I know we talk in our film, Cats on the Internet, a lot about how the Fourth Amendment applies to digital privacy. So I know you've written extensively on this topic, and there's so much we could get into. But you had a very interesting article about the meaning of the term search. And I was wondering if you could explain why it's so disputed when it comes to digital data.
Yeah, great. So now you're going to regret it, but I'm going to go on a long, open-ended answer to your question. The key to all of this, right, is that the Fourth Amendment text is very short. And so it's basically one long sentence. And it says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. So that's the key part of the Fourth Amendment, or the part that I'm going to talk about. And so you can see from that text that it applies specifically to searches and seizures. And so it's not a general regulation of the government or police conduct. It targets a specific kind of government conduct, searches and seizures. And while seizures is pretty easily interpreted in the sense of the police grabbing you, that's a seizure, like an arrest is a seizure. The court has had, especially in modern times, has had all sorts of trouble figuring out what searches means in this context. And that's been true for, say, like since the 1960s, that the court has struggled to define what the Fourth Amendment means by searches. And what I tried to do in my article is to say, take a step back and say, you know, while there are lots of terms in the Constitution that are difficult to interpret, that are kind of inescapably fuzzy, like the word reasonable, which comes up later in the Fourth Amendment, or due process, right? These are difficult terms to define. The word search actually isn't a difficult word to define. If you were talking with your friends and someone said, you know, oh, I can't believe you searched my room, people wouldn't be confused about what was meant there. We would all have a pretty strong sense of what the term search means. And so what I try to do in my article is to say, while there are difficult interpretive problems with the Fourth Amendment, we don't need to add to them by making search a difficult to define term. We actually can use the definition we already know for search, and then also for the other words that I also mentioned, persons, houses, papers, and effects. We can use those terms to make a concrete doctrine of what the Fourth Amendment applies to. And kind of as I indicated earlier, I think it's very important to have clear rules in this space, clear rules that say to the police, you can't do this, and that tell courts you can't allow the police to do this. Because if you don't have clear rules, while it allows for the police and the courts to do things that you might, allows the courts to create restrictions that you like, when you create a lot of wiggle room and a lot of ambiguity, often that's going to let judges just do whatever they want. And the history in this area has been that that means that judges usually line up on the government side in these cases.
Gotcha. So from what you're saying, it kind of sounds like we have the text of the Fourth Amendment, and you think that's like pretty straightforward reading it, right? But then you run into the interpretation, and there's just so much ambiguity in there, and that has had some significant consequences.
Yeah, and the key insight that I tried to push is that it's the court's fault, right? The actual language, this part of the language, search, is not difficult to interpret. It requires some interpretation, especially as it gets into the gray areas. But what happened was the Supreme Court, instead of using the term search, which is what it had done for a long time, just said, like, obviously this is a search and obviously this is not a search. In the 1960s, as your movie talks about, the court decided Katz. And in Katz, instead of applying the kind of common understanding of the term search, the court said a search is when the government invades a reasonable expectation of privacy. And when that took over as the definition of search, you know, those terms, reasonable expectation of privacy, those terms have no clear content. And so what the Supreme Court basically did was said, search will mean what we tell you it means in cases going forward. And that is good or bad, depending on how much you trust judges to decide kind of post hoc the contents of your rights.
Certainly a double-edged sword at the very least. So you mentioned a reasonable expectation of privacy, and I think it's described in our film as a term of art. Can you try to explain exactly what the Supreme Court meant with that?
Sure. Well, I'm going to give you a behind-the-scenes look at what the Supreme Court meant by reasonable expectation of privacy. They were saying, we really think the Fourth Amendment should apply to this context, which was the government bugging a telephone booth. And they said, well, it's not obvious that the doctrine we've had so far would apply in this situation. And so we're going to change the doctrine to say kind of the result they wanted. The result they wanted was the government can't do this unless they have a warrant. And to get to that result, they said it had to be a search. And so to make it a search, they said, like, what don't we like about this scenario? And what they didn't like was that Katz was in a phone booth with a door that closed. People have to imagine these because they don't exist anymore. But in that space, in a phone booth, in a closed space using a public phone, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and the government invaded that. And that, the court says in 1967, that is the new definition of search. And so now the government needs a warrant to put a listening device on the telephone booth. And I think the best way to understand what was going on was the court had reached a dead end. They weren't able to reach that language. They weren't able to reach that result. They didn't think they could reach that result easily by just applying a textual application of what the Fourth Amendment said. And so they came up with a more broad kind of formulation. And that's great because it lets the court get to a result that a lot of people would like. But the problem is playing that forward. Now you have courts deciding what's a reasonable expectation of privacy. And then a lot of future cases, the courts predictably were coming to results that people didn't like. And that's always going to happen if you create an amorphous formulation for a right. Sometimes it's going to hit good answers and sometimes it's going to hit bad answers. But basically what you've done is you've just left it up to the judges down the road to tell you whether your rights have been violated or not. And as I was saying, it's really problematic in this space because what you want is you want the police to have clear rules, right? You know, whatever you want to say about the police, they're not going to follow kind of guidelines the same way that the Supreme Court thinks about guidelines. But, your best chance at reining in the government is to say, clearly, these are the things you can and can't do. And if you don't say it clearly, there's going to be a lot of, what's that expression, like asking for forgiveness afterwards. That's only part of the expression. There's an expression that goes there.
Sure thing. No, so it sounds like this has really carried through to today's digital world in a lot of really interesting ways. Are we seeing that like with a lot of police investigations? Does this come up all the time?
Well, certainly the police are doing things that might or might not constitute searches all the time. And one of the things that the doctrine does, because it's not clear, is that the police have to kind of decide for themselves, does this count as a search or not? And then they can kind of err on various sides. One thing they can do, which is a good thing, is they can say, well, we're not sure if we need a warrant for this, so let's just get a warrant to make sure. And so that would be, I guess, a privacy protective type of thing, and that would be good. But the other thing they could do is they could say, well, it's not clear if we need a warrant, let's just do it anyway, and then see what the courts say later. And, you know, when I first wrote the article of Fourth Amendment textualism that you're referring to, one of the things I said is that the problem with the formula is that we have to wait for the Supreme Court to tell us when it applies, and they only decide one or two cases a year. Well, lately, they haven't decided any cases at all. So it's actually down to closer to zero cases a year. And so it's really up to lower courts to decide this. And that means the rules are different in different jurisdictions. And all of which goes to say that you might like in the abstract the reasonable expectation of privacy test. But if you actually want there to be rules that lower courts are going to consistently apply, you're going to have to come up with something clearer. And the Supreme Court hasn't done that. And it seems like they're less and less interested in walking into this terrain any further.
So if the Supreme Court is fairly disinterested in solving this issue, what do you think is the best way to go about fixing it? Or are we just stuck dealing with an imperfect process that has a lot of ambiguity?
Well, and you know, it's tricky. So I've been talking about the rights of, you know, the privacy rights, and that's where people usually focus their analysis. But there's another side to this, which is, you know, there are certainly, I think everyone would agree, there are certain types of government activities that where we really do want the government to assertively go forward and solve mysteries, right? So I was just reading about the serial killer in Long Island, and what he was doing allegedly was using these burner phones to call escorts, and then he would kill them. And so the only clue the police had were that the escorts' phones had been contacted by the same kind of phone number. And then what they did is they went out and they asked the cell phone providers for like all the places this phone could be found or all the phone pings in the area of these killings. And, you know, I think most people would say like, good, we want the police to do stuff like that. And so the flip side of what I was talking about is if it's unclear, you know, what the police can do in these contexts, that kind of quashes police investigation, right? It'd be better to have in that kind of case, right? And the same kind of thing happened in the Boston Marathon bombing, right? There's like a lot of surveillance footage, and the government went aggressively and got all this surveillance footage. And so certain things like these extreme events, we really do want the government to be able to access this kind of information and solve you know, horrific crimes and protect people from ongoing victimization. And so, you know, it's problematic to just say, well, the government shouldn't be able to do this, or the government shouldn't, you know, should get a warrant in all these circumstances, because sometimes you wouldn't be able to get a warrant. You don't have enough information to specify exactly what you're doing. And so getting, this is a long way of answering your question, you know, there is value in clarification here. And one thing that can happen is the legislatures can step in where the Supreme Court is not and say, here are the things that we want. One of the things, and this is, I've written another article called crime severity distinctions in the Fourth Amendment, which is about this very point, that one of the things that's missing from Fourth Amendment analysis is what is the government doing? And it seems to me that we should be more permissive when the government is investigating something really important, like the Boston Marathon bombing or the serial killings in Long Island. And it's less significant if the government's doing something else, like looking for drug deals or, you know, people speeding and things like that. And so we could have different rules depending on what the government's doing. And that actually exists in other statutes, like wiretapping statutes have rules about you can do this if it's a severe crime and you can't do it if it's a minor crime. And so that's something that's good about the legislature. They can make these kind of fine grain analysis, which the Supreme Court, even, you know, I'm criticizing them for not taking, you know, more cases. But even if they took more cases, it's very hard for the Supreme Court piece by piece to create a comprehensive landscape of regulation, because they're just not going to get enough cases to come up with a consistent principle that covers everything, especially because there's so much new that's unfolding. And so it actually would be valuable for the legislature to create more robust frameworks for this kind of thing. And then my last point, though, about the where there are these important government investigations is it's really hard, right? Part of what's going on is the Supreme Court's not doing enough of this. But on the other hand, the Supreme Court is just interpreting this small text that really, like I said, is narrowly targeted to searches and seizures. And so if we want really comprehensive legislation that gets at all this digital stuff and all the new technologies, that's going to have to come from legislatures, not from the court. And it's going to be really hard, right? It's not as easy as just saying, let's put as many restrictions on the government as we can. Because while certainly there are good reasons to restrict the government, sometimes we want the government to go and solve really important crimes and protect us from really dangerous things, say spread of COVID disease, right? Things like that. If we want the government to be able to figure out like where is there a lot of COVID, where is there not a lot of COVID, that requires tapping data, maybe Google searches on people talking about their symptoms, right? And you know, let's say the next illness that comes like that. There are times we want the government to step up and access this data and figure things out. And I think medical data is a great example of that. So we really want to be protective of medical data on the one hand. On the other hand, medical data can be really important to protecting society, and that's kind of government's role. And if you notice during the COVID pandemic, a lot of the information about what was going on was coming out of England because they had a system that was capturing all this data about what was going on. Almost none of it was coming out of the United States because we have this weird, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. It's kind of schizophrenic view of digital stuff. And we're very protective of medical privacy. And so we can't access some of the information that at times would be really helpful for protecting us.
Oh, that is really interesting to see that in action on the ground and the consequences. It's definitely an issue that bears some serious thinking.
Yeah, I actually would just say, like, I'm very nervous about telling people, like, you must do this to protect privacy, because I'm a law professor, right? That, I'm not an expert on what the right balance is between what the government should be able to access and what the government shouldn't be able to access. I do think these are important issues. I also think people should be careful about asking that question of, like, the right parties, right? So, you know, if someone is, you know, at even a school like Yale or somewhere, and they're really smart, but all they think about is protecting privacy, they might not have the best answer for what the balance is. And if you ask someone, you know, who's working for the FBI, all they think about is these threats that are looming on the horizon. They also might not have the best answer. And it's really difficult to figure out, like, who knows the answer to how we strike this balance between privacy and safety.
So for someone who's thinking about this seriously, what would you say is the most important thing to consider about this whole issue with privacy and safety and trying to balance those when it comes to personal information on cell phones and personal devices?
Well, so, you know, thank you for asking me that question after my last rambling, because I think that informs where I am on this, like what's different about my opinion than a lot of other people. And I think a kind of humility is the key to this. Right. Not being sure that you know exactly where this line should be drawn and being open to the idea that, you know, it's a line that we're just going to have to do our best at getting it right because there's problems with erring on both sides. And so, you know, a kind of humility as we approach this of, you know, what is the best way to balance really important interests on both sides of the equation and accepting that we might not be able to get this exactly right. And there is harm in saying, like, no more of this technology, no more of this. Say, like, I think the medical example is as good as any. You know, there you can find people who would be very strong and compelling advocates for we must protect medical privacy 100%. And, you know, like, that's the most important privacy and of how dare anyone access medical records and things like that. But then you can talk to doctors and researchers in the medical field who explain all the types of life-saving things we could achieve if we had broader access to medical data over populations and things like that. And so that's where I am on just kind of a humility about this, that yes, this is important. Yes, we need to bring more clarity to this area, but it's really hard. These are really hard questions. And that's where, like, for me, one of the places we could really focus our energy is saying, what is the government doing? And if the government is doing something that is important and valuable, like trying to stop the spread of disease or trying to stop like a bombing or something like that, then we're going to let the government have the tools or we'll make it easier to access the tools. And if we're not doing something like that, then we'll be less likely. But I'm really worried about solutions that are no, the government can't access this, period. Because it's easy to say that in the, you know, in your law school office. And then something happens when we do want the government to act, but we've already made it so they can't use a certain tool. And I think that would be problematic.
Absolutely. It's funny how that works, where you think it would work one way in theory, but then you see it on the ground and it's just completely different.
Yeah, and the same on the opposite, right? So, you know, I'm in a law school setting, so I have, that's my vantage point. But I think it also happens when reporters and people are talking to the FBI and, you know, police, and the mindset there is just the opposite, that, you know, everything is a crisis. And so we need these tools for everything. And that has been a lot of what's happened. So I referenced the wiretap statutes, which are connected to crime severity. The police can do more in terms of tapping phones if they're looking at more serious crimes. But the, as you could probably guess, the list of what counts as a serious crime has expanded over the years and encompasses a lot of things that I think probably shouldn't be there. And so there is a tendency, you know, wherever you put these powers, for there to be like mission creep, where the, if we give the government certain powers, they try to extend them to everything, because why isn't this serious? Why isn't this serious? You know, like I talked about speeding tickets, then people be like, well, traffic accidents are serious, or drugs are serious, right? All these things are serious, but it's a question of proportionality, right? Like figuring out when we can use the most invasive tools and when we can't.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Jeff, for joining us today on the FedSoc Films podcast. Before you go, where can our listeners find more about you and your work?
Well, so thanks for mentioning my article. So I think that a neat intro to this topic is the Fourth Amendment Textualism article, which was published by Michigan Law Review. And people can find that just by searching on Fourth Amendment Textualism, which I probably should trademark at some point, but I haven't yet. So feel free to swoop in, grab that trademark, but on your way, read the article. And then obviously you can reach out through my website.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Jeff. This has been a fascinating conversation. And thank you folks for listening in. You can find our film, Cats on the Internet, on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.